Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Awakening Consciousness with Asher and Jesse. Got a good show for you today. We're going to be talking about cyber attacks and, the potential attack on the global financial system. So they've been running some drills, running some simulations, and whenever this happens, there's always a chance that something gets translated over into the real world. So we're going to be taking a look at an article. Doesn't go into a whole lot of detail, but it talks about some countries that are running these drills and preparing for a cyber attack on the financial system. And I would argue that there could also be cyber attacks on other systems as well, including the financial system. Including the energy grid. And so this is just one of the things that they are preparing for. And so we're going to be breaking that down and hopefully making some sense out of things. So anything to add before we get started?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. No, I'll jump into it in a minute.
All right. So Grand Rising, everyone. Thank Dark Cacao. Let me see. Let me just put this link in some of our other places. Where is it? Here we go. And all right, now let me find the article.
Yeah, while you're pulling that up, I guess one thing to just put some context on the article. Again, talking about this yesterday and probably many times, it seems like to me that we're in a new phase here, right? You've got governments around the world sort of signaling rollbacks, right? And we covered this sort of in depth yesterday, but they're implementing rollbacks of mandates. They're, allowing people some respite here, some sort of return to, some semblance of normalcy. It seems that's what they're signaling. And so we're at this different time, right? It seems like whatever comes next, and that could be a break, right? That could be some time off, right? That could be sort of things are quiet for a while, right? We don't know, but whatever comes next, it seems like we're transitioning here. And so that's why, it's in that context, right? That we're going to discuss, run the government running drills around cybersecurity and these sorts of things.
Yeah. All right. So here we go. All right. So exclusive IMF. This is from December 9th. So it's a little over a month ago. And as far as I know, nothing has happened, but it doesn't mean that nothing will happen. And I think it is true that whenever a big event happens in the world, I think that it was preceded in many cases, if not just about all cases, by a drill or some sort of simulation. And so that's kind of the MO, so to speak. So Jerusalem, December 9th, Israel on Thursday led a 10-country simulation of a major cyber attack on the global financial system in an attempt to increase cooperation that could help to minimize any potential damage to financial markets and banks. The simulated war game, in quotes, Israel's finance minister called it and planned over the past year, evolved over 10 days with sensitive data emerging on the dark web. The simulation also used fake news reports that in the scenario caused chaos in global markets and a run on banks. The simulation likely caused by what officials call sophisticated players, featured several types of attacks that impacted global foreign exchange and bond markets, liquidity, integrity of data, and transactions between importers and exporters. Should we stop there and talk about this for a second?
Yeah, sure. And just to go back, Asher, to what you were saying at the very beginning, I just want to drive that point home, right? We've got was it Event 201, I think was the conference, right? Or something 201 that they did, outlining a global pandemic and government, global viral pandemic and government response, and, you know, how citizens would respond and how government would respond to citizens. And they ran through, you know, the whole scenario that played out here, right? And we've seen that same, phenomenon happen over and over again, right? So, you know, on 9/11, right, they're running drills, you know, the same drills, right? And we've seen this over and over again. That's true of 7/7. It's true of the Oklahoma City bombing. It's true of just on and on. They always seem to practice first. They always seem to, you know, sort of game plan war strategy, you know, and war game, and then they put out reports and they sort of signal, and then the stuff kind of happens. And so I just want to drive that home, sort of again, as you did mention, so we're talking about another simulated strategic, you know, what if this happens, right? We really want to be ready if this happens, scenario at this time. So that's why it's interesting, right?
Yeah, I think a recent one was the gas shortage that happened on the East Coast of the U.S. It hit North Carolina, where I live, pretty good. There was a couple of days where it was difficult to get gas. A lot of gas stations were out. And that was, I think that was also a quote unquote cyber attack or an issue with, information sharing or something along those lines, where this is the next level of quote unquote terrorism, because the average person or, you know, the public in general can't ever, you know, we don't have access to these systems. We don't have, we can't see what's going on. And so it could very easily be, you know, hey, you know, this happened and, you know, we have no way to trace it, no way to figure out what's really going on. And so they could just essentially run a drill or something like that, make it go live, and then, you know, disrupt the energy system, the energy grid, the financial system. You know, your credit cards don't work, your bank assets are frozen, something like that. I remember back in, I think it was 2010 in Cyprus, they had bail-ins where they basically just confiscated people's money in their bank accounts. And, people will say like, oh, well, we have the FDIC that's insuring our accounts up to $250,000. And it's like, yeah, well, I'm not sure it's going to work like that when you're basically a creditor to the bank when you have your funds in a bank account. You're essentially giving them the right to use your funds, and you've become a creditor. It's not your money. You are lending your money to the bank, and they can do whatever they want with it. And so,
and in this case, the borrower is a terrible credit risk. The only reason the only reason they have any ability to be the borrower in that scenario that you're outlining, which is absolutely correct, is that they have the sort of the full faith and forthright of the United States government, essentially, even though, you know, that's the banks are private ostensibly, but everybody understands that. Right. So, there, you know, this is with fractional reserve lending and with, you know, the amount that banks have to keep on reserve. I'm actually saying that quite seriously, like they're not a good credit risk to a creditor.
If people are unfamiliar with fractional reserve banking, the bank takes in money, they have your money, they don't necessarily keep it in a vault in the bank, but they lend it out to other people, and they don't actually give you a suitcase full of full of cash. Obviously, they type whatever number they want into an account or send it to another account, and they only need to keep something like 1% of the amount of money they loan out in reserves at whatever you know, whatever vault they have. And so what that does is it creates a lot more money in the system that needs to be paid back at interest. And so this is the way that they basically create money out of thin air. It's not necessarily printing presses, you know, like we always say, like, oh, the Federal Reserve is printing more money. That's not actually the phenomenon that's happening. It's banks lending out way more money than they have in reserve, and then collecting that money back at interest from people. And so that's how the money supply has continued to grow. I think I've seen articles saying that something like 80% of the money in existence in the U.S. today has been created in the last 2 years or something like that.
Wow.
Something like that. Yeah. It's,
I mean, that's what happens at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have the kind of hyperbolic expansion of the money supply, which that money has to go somewhere. And so, you know, it's been going into asset prices, but I think it's trickling its way into other parts of the economy, the consumer good parts of the economy. And that's why we're seeing an uptick in the quote unquote inflation rate. And what that really is it's the CPI index, the consumer price index, that has been, highest increases in the CPI since a long time, probably 70s or 80s. And so, based on production and value. Bob and Ann says they loan out money based on production and value. For example, you buy a car, you get loaned an amount of money based on the value of the car and your ability to pay it. Yes, to a certain extent, but you know, one of the problems that was created with the 2008 financial crisis was banks were lending money to people who couldn't pay it and who weren't good credit risks, who, you know, could basically you know, who weren't able to pay back the loans, which also, because they loaned out so much money at low interest rates, it drives up the price of whatever assets people are buying at the time. In this case, it was housing. So you have this a double-edged sword where people who aren't good credit risks are getting loans that they never had the ability to pay back. It drives up the prices of houses for everyone else. Everyone thinks that, oh, the housing market is going up, I'm going to buy houses and get in on this. And then many people then default on their loans, and the value of the housing market crashes, and then everyone else is underwater on their loans. And that's when we have the financial crisis. So it's not necessarily based on production value and your ability to pay back the loan. Sometimes there are external forces that say, hey, you got to lend to all these people because you're racist if you're not. And so that, that has the effect of driving up loans when they wouldn't have been given out in the first place. And so that was one of the leading causes of the 2008 financial crisis.
That's very well explained, and of course that, you know, when you're you have to understand that it's sort of like aggregate, right? When the banks are quote unquote lending money, which means that they're creating new currency and increasing the money supply, right? So when the banks are lending, aka increasing the money supply, as Asher pointed out, right, creating new money out of thin air based off of the value of your signature, right? So the loan itself is the value, right? The instrument, the fact that you signed this document and said, I agree to pay all this back, right? That is the value. That is where it comes from. And so, when that happens and the banks are lending and the money supply is increasing, you are having all of this new debt, all this new interest, all this new pressure really to go into the economy, into the consumer. And so when the banks in aggregate, right, lend more and increase the money supply or pull back and decrease the money supply, what they do then is they create the cycle. And so when you have, you know, the decreasing money supply, you're, because of the system that has been created for us, right, it's so precarious, right? Because we have fractional reserve lending and we have, you know, this, whatever you're talking about, the reserves, you know, I don't know, you mentioned 1%. I don't know any of those rules, you know, well, but because we have such the banks are in always such a precarious situation where they're, first of all, banks, by the way, I don't know if people know this, banks are not allowed by law. They are not allowed to lend their own money. I don't know if people like know that, you know, like if me and you, Asher, we wanted to get together and put our money together and start a bank, we're not allowed. Like, you and I can't put our own money into the pool that we then use to lend out to our clients and customers. That is illegal. So banks don't put money together and then lend it.
Right.
Savings and loans may do that. I'm less familiar with that, but right. So what banks do is they create money out of thin air at the time that you're borrowing it. And that's legally how they're able to operate. They're not able to operate in a different way. So we have this whole global financial system, right, that a pinprick can destroy. And because there's so much leverage, there's leverage throughout the entire system. We have a system where we have, you know, literally amounts of repayment that the currency doesn't exist in the world to repay, right? That's where we're at here, right? We have the whole world scrambling to repay, but there's not enough of the thing that they need to, right? There's not enough dollars, not enough, literally. I mean that like actually. So what happens now when we're talking about, you know, we go back, you mentioned 2008, right? What did we have in 2008? Like a tiny little hiccup in the debt markets, right? That almost collapsed the world, apparently. So where are we at here now? Well, we're much more leveraged, right? The money supply has increased by a gargantuan amount. I mean, you mentioned 80% of all currency in the last 2 years. That wouldn't surprise me at all. That's what the charts look like. So that's, you know, that's probably an accurate number. So we're at a much more precarious situation than we were in 2008. And we've got Israel and the powers that be, you know, simulating cyber attacks on financial markets and debt markets and things like that. And it, you know, it's, you don't have to do a lot of dot connecting to, you know, to sort of feel like, okay, we may be getting closer to those sorts of scenarios than not. Again, stuff we expect, right? We all understand that this is coming at some point. I don't know that it's even something that we necessarily, I necessarily am worried, oh, I really don't want this to happen now. I really want it to happen 2 years from now. Yeah, I don't know that that even, I personally don't care, you know, when they do that. We have to go through that. You know, we have to live through that time. It's going to happen no matter what. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Bob Ann says the things the money is loaned for are the real assets the money is created for. The banks do not create money without an asset someone is using the money for. Money only represents production and value. Well, a couple things. So yes, the money is loaned to buy a real asset in many cases, but
maybe
what happens when the interest rates are artificially suppressed and you can basically get access to money at much cheaper prices, that's interest rate, than what should be available in the economy. So if you can get a mortgage on a house at 2.4%, which is around what I've got my house at, you know, I can afford to pay more for the same amount of house. And now if that happens with everyone else can afford to pay more for the same amount of house, because you're not calculating the price that you can pay for a house based on the total price. You're calculating based on the monthly payment that you'll have to make. Can I make this payment on a monthly basis? And so what happens when you have interest rates this low is it drives up the price of houses. At the same time, maybe there's going to be less people around to support this level of housing production. Maybe there's going to be less demand for bigger houses because people aren't able to, you know, people aren't working as much and they aren't able to support those monthly payments. And so you have a case where you've driven up the prices of these assets because people can afford the monthly payment at the certain time. But if there's a hit to the economy where, you know, people are out of work, or there's, you know, stoppages to the supply chain or disruptions or, you know, medical procedures that are causing havoc, then it's going to wreak havoc. And then people aren't able to make those monthly payments. And when people aren't able to make those monthly payments, then that's when a lot of, you know, bad stuff can happen. The housing market could crash like it did in 2008. And a lot of other things can happen because, as you mentioned, banks are so levered and interconnected with each other that a prick to one bank can have ripple effects to many other banks. And we have big, huge banks. I think Deutsche Bank is one of the biggest, and they're in a huge amount of trouble. And that could have ripple effects to many other banks around the world. And so I think if you look at Deutsche Bank stock, it was, you know, well over $100, you know, a few years ago, and now it's under 10, I think. And so, you know, it's a sign of big troubles in the financial system. Everyone's levered to the hills and everyone's connected to everyone else. And so when that scenario happens, then it can only take a minor disruption to really cause a major havoc.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And it's important also to just note, you know, these are long-term plans and they connect into a lot of things, right? We could easily see a situation where, you know, there's some sort of cyber attack, quote unquote, which is then blamed for disruptions in the financial markets, which are then blamed on Russia, which then China jumps into their defense, right? And all of a sudden, you know, we've got a scenario where we've got one side of the powers of the world, you know, blaming the other side of the powers of the world, and that gets more and more animus, and you know, you can lead to war and things like that. And it's just important to understand that these things are all long-term plays, right, by the powers that be. So the fact, right, that the financial system is the way it is, right, where the leverage is to the point that we're talking about, where a tiny pinprick, you know, tiny anything in one little piece of the market can send the whole thing, you know, collapsing, literally, right, into collapse. That's what was all done intentionally, right? And so now we have this situation where we understand that they want to move on from the dollar. We understand that we're moving into a, you know, the Great Reset, right? And we're moving into some sort of new economic system and the rise of China and all these sorts of things. This has been in the, you know, this has been in the works for a very long time. And so now under this scenario, right, where we have the financial system and the bank system is so precarious, designed that way. Right. So now when we do have, and then we're, you know, we're running drills on cyber attacks and we're saber rattling with Russia and all these sorts of things. So now when, you know, when we do have that hiccup in the debt markets or the financial markets, whether that comes from, you know, a false flag cyber attack, or whether that comes from a legitimate event, or whether that is simply the only possible conclusion that this sort of system can have is collapse at the end, right? So you can't have a debt-based fiat monetary system that doesn't collapse, right? So mathematically speaking. So when we, you know, when we have those sorts of things, right, we get right into that problem reaction solution where, you know, these things have happened, and we go right to the narrative that they've had, you know, planned all along. So whether that's war, whether that's new currency, whether that's, you know, people just suffering because, you know, there's the economic conditions, so on and so forth. So it's just important to understand that when you're sitting and you're kind of looking at all the analysis and all the talking heads talking about, you know, we have this problem and this aspect. And, you know, if banks just, you know, I remember in 2009, 10, and those, you know, the stress tests, right? And if we just have to, you know, we just have to raise the capital requirements, and, you know, let's talk about the pros and cons of raising the capital requirements and the, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, when you hear all that stuff, you have to understand that they're just pointing out aspects within the system that they see that are like a big problem right then, but the entire system is designed that way. So we're talking, you know, so it's just important to understand that this is all, you know, these are all part of long-term plans. And not even, again, I come back to two, not necessarily a negative thing that these events are going to happen, right? Like they need to happen. This is a corrupt system that steals our labor from us, steals our life force from us, right? Quite literally. So it, that needs to come down. And the fact that it's designed to come down, and the fact that, you know, they want to take it down also because they have to get to their next phases, not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. Bob and Ann says, let me see. Where is it? Their error is loaning to governments who are chronic defaulters throughout history, and the government and kings always blame the blank whom they owe the money to. I think bank. It serves the interest of the government to be able to borrow as much money as they want to go into as much debt as they want, because government officials, you never get elected into office by claiming that you're going to reel in spending and reduce the government benefits for everyone. You get voted into office by promising the world to everyone and not worrying about how to pay for it. And so, so it's in the best interest of the governments to go into debt. And then once, you know, they run up massive amounts of debt and they can't afford to pay it back, or at least the interest on the debt takes up more and more of the available funds, meaning the taxes that they collect. And so we've gotten to the point where just the interest alone on the U.S. debt takes up such a high percentage of the overall revenues that it's to the point where, there is no going back. There is no repaying the debt and getting out of debt and all that stuff. It's an ever increasing cycle of needing to pay more and more. And if interest rates ever increase, because, you know, the government is borrowing this money at sort of rock bottom interest rates, and if the interest rate ever increased significantly, it would make repaying or making the payments on the debts that much more difficult. And so, and when we're talking about planned, so this is planned above the level of your regional bank. This is planned way above that. This is, you know, so Bob and Ann is questioning whether this is actually planned or not. How is destroying the economy even a plan? Well, what we're talking about there is the shift away from the U.S. being the superpower and into sort of other competing countries, Russia, China, more specifically. And in order to get a sort of worldwide outright, you know, sort of one world government slave system in place, they need to destroy the U.S. economy and reduce the production power, the producing power, and the freedom that is sort of the U.S., the sort of beacon of freedom. And that's been part of the plan. And so what they've done is they've hollowed out the manufacturing base. The U.S. doesn't produce anything anymore. They've outsourced that to China and other countries with lower labor costs. And so it's hollowed out the U.S. economy. And so I think something like 25% or more percent of the U.S. economy is in the financial sector, which really doesn't create any economic value at all. It's just placing bets on other things that are happening in the economy. It's not actually producing a good that someone can then consume. It's just moving money around and making bets and buying things, selling them, trading, that kind of stuff. And it actually doesn't make people wealthy, but it does make people wealthy, but it doesn't make a country wealthy. It makes certain people paper wealthy by controlling assets. It doesn't actually produce anything that people are using in their day-to-day lives. And so when you have this much of the economy in the financial sector, you're basically creating paper wealth, but not actual wealth that can be, shared by the, sort of common people who are, hopefully producing goods. That's real wealth. And so that's really the plan. It's to hollow out the productive base of the US economy, move it overseas, and then the sort of weight of the financial system and the debt and everything else makes it crumble from the top down.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Let's go back to the Great Reset idea for a second. So, you're laying out this scenario that I think is not only plausible, it's probably even somewhat likely, right? So you're laying out this scenario where, hey, we've got governments who have increased money supply a gargantuan amount, aka debt. So, and as you mentioned, they're borrowing essentially close to 0% interest at very low interest rates. However, of course, what all that additional monetary supply does is it creates, generally speaking, some inflation and some need for higher interest rates in order to combat that. And so in that sort of situation where interest rates are rising and those payments are becoming impossible, then as you outlined, then things like a financial system reset are extremely necessary. And so there's a reason that they've, set all that up now, right? Because we're at the end here of that game. And so, whether that scenario plays out that way or a different way, and that will be part of it no matter what. And I think, it's a very likely scenario when governments, throw their hands up and say, boy, we just don't know how this problem started. Yeah. We did our best. We called Paul Volcker, I don't know if he's still around or alive. He told us what to do. We listened, we got Paul Krugman on the phone. We like him, Paul Krugman. Right.
The guy said the internet would be as have as big of an impact on the economy as the fax machine. So that's Paul Krugman for you.
Right. That's great.
Nobel award winning economist.
Yeah. And he's insane. I mean, if you listen to him talk, there's not anything he says that makes any sense. It's amazing to hear him talk. And then people just absolutely love him because he talks in platitudes. He doesn't talk about economics. And since his entire fan base doesn't have 1% of information about economics, knowledge on economics, they think he's great because he just gives them liberal platitudes while making zero sense from an economic standpoint. It's absolutely hilarious. But, So at the end of the day, right, when governments throw their hands up and just say, man, we just couldn't fight this inflation anymore. And actually, we can't even repay the debt. We screwed up, guys. We're really sorry. Great. We got the economic reset. They got the new, the new thing coming, the solution, and they can just kind of slide us right into that. So I think, again, a pretty likely scenario.
Yeah. All right. Let's continue. Let's continue with the economy. Or the article, sorry. All right, so Israeli government officials said that such threats are possible in the wake of the many high-profile cyber attacks on large companies, and that the only way to contain any damage is through global cooperation, since current cybersecurity is not always strong enough. So I wonder what that is forecasting. Is there going to be a global currency system that's put in place, a sort of central bank issued digital currency system. I think that's what they've been working towards for a while. I don't know if they'll get there, but I think that is the goal. Attackers are 10 steps ahead of the defender. Misha Weiss, financial cyber manager of Israel's finance ministry, told Reuters. Participants in the initiative called Collective Strength included Treasury officials from Israel, the U.S., U.K., United Arab Emirates, Austria, Switzerland, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, and Thailand, as well as representatives from the International Monetary Fund, World Bank, and Bank of International Settlements. So you have all the big players here. Yep. Let's see what else. The narrator of the film in the simulation said governments were under pressure to clarify the impact of the attack, which was paralyzing the global financial system. The banks are appealing for emergency liquidity assistance in a multitude of currencies to put a halt to the chaos as counterparties withdraw their funds and limit access to liquidity, leaving the banks in disarray and ruin, the narrator said. So as people, as you know, an attack comes, people rush to take their currency out of the system, which creates a run on the banks, which creates a liquidity crisis, because as we were talking about in the beginning, banks don't have the money that they're lending out. They just type it into your account and it's something like 1% or something like that is held in reserves of the total amount of money that they have lended into the system. And so your money actually isn't there. You agree to lend your money to the banks at that point by putting it into a bank account. And so this is a good reminder that I need to do something about with my business accounts and potentially diversify. So maybe I'll take a look at that. But yeah, and so this run on the banks creates a liquidity crisis, which means that they're going to be appealing to the bigger banks in the system, the IMF, the World Bank, the BIS, and they're going to be asking for liquidity, which means cash. And so they need extra cash in order to satisfy the withdrawal requests, and it leaves a, you know, sort of chaos ensues. So that's the scenario they're laying out there.
Yeah. And again, right, and this is the point, they tell you, right? They tell you kind of in advance what they're up to and what they're doing. So here we are sharing this information, right? This is what they're up to. This is what they're doing. This is a likely scenario. They're telling you in that article, right? Like, you're going to have a hard time getting your money, right? Yeah. It says it. And so that's really the point. And of course, you know, if you want to look at the whole thing, I mean, sure, right? The banks are insolvent. They're insolvent because they're designed to be insolvent. And then when they're on the verge of collapse, we try to solve that insolvency with liquidity, which simply keeps the game going a little longer. And so, but the banks are in a position that, you know, the banks are in a position where their insolvency cannot be solved under the current rules, period. So they cannot ever not be insolvent. So they're going to be on the precipice of collapse always, because it's designed that way. And so, you know, so we can, you know, we did this in 08, right? We had a solvency issue. We tried to solve it with liquidity, which led to a massive increase in the money supply and a greater solvency issue, right? So, you know, so this is where we're at here. If I was, you know, thinking about this strategically, not, which I have been for a long time, so it wouldn't be any change, you know, now, but what I would be thinking about is, yeah, I would want my, you know, I want my assets that matter to me out of that system, out of the banking system. I want them in places I feel more comfortable, that I have, you know, a much less degree of leverage to the powers that be, right, and their plans and the debt-based monetary system and so on and so forth. And I would be understanding, as we've been talking about all along, whether it's the supply chain stuff, whether it's what we're talking about now, whether it's just sort of draconian, you know, measures and so on and so forth, you know, we all just should be angling our ships, angling our life towards sovereignty, self-autonomy, self-efficiency, and just extricating ourselves from the system. Because all of these events that are coming, in my opinion, essentially are inevitable. But they can be inevitable in the sense, like, I believe they have been and will be for me. I believe probably, you know, I believe definitely for you too, where there are events that you're sort of watching as a spectator, sort of, you know, checking it out and having a look, like you might turn on a movie for a couple of hours, right? They're not events that necessarily have to send anyone into running and screaming and panic, because we knew they were coming and we're prepared and it's just part of the thing. And we understand that and we're all good with that, right? So that's the difference, you know, for people. So that's, you know, that's why it matters, right? That's why understanding what's happening and what they're up to matters, because you can put yourself in a position where you realize how impotent they really are, because they are, because the whole thing is, you know, the whole thing is free will. The whole thing is choice. The whole thing is consent.
Yeah. Yeah. Bob and Ann says the banks are insolvent because they own government debt, and no bank wants the European debt because they know that Europe will default soon. So yeah, I think Europe is further along in the collapse process than the US. Certainly the banks are. We mentioned Deutsche Bank as one of the poster childs for you know, a mismanaged bank that owns tons of toxic debt and probably has a major liquidity crisis, and that's been reflected in their share price. And you know, a small hiccup in the derivatives market or something like that could, you know, any small thing could sort of set that off and have a cascading effect on other banks. And so, you know, I think the problem is much more systemic. And I think that, you know, it's sort of the incentives that have been put in place based on the system that are designed like this. It's not necessarily that, you know, the manager of a bank, you know, goes out and says, you know what, you know, it'd be good business practice if we just lend out everything we can to whoever wants it. And then we just collect that back. The incentives are set up in a way that they have to lend out money in order to stay profitable. And so because they've lent out so much money to so many different people, and then there could be a hiccup in the economy, you know, maybe there's a health scare, or maybe there's a supply chain issues or something like that, then it has an effect on the loans that they're collecting on. And a small decrease in the rate of payback has a major impact on their financial success. And it's like, that's the nature of the debt-based fiat money system. It's, you know, it's government debt. Banks are the largest holders of government debt. Yeah. I mean, government debt is a huge problem. You know, we talked about this a few minutes ago, where the government goes into greater and greater amounts of debt. It becomes a larger and larger percentage of the budget, and to the point where they're only able to make these payments because the interest rates are so low. And if the interest rates go up, as they probably should, and just do over, you know, the market at some point will determine the interest rates. If it's not, it's not doing so now. It's basically set by the Fed. But at some point, the market is going to determine the interest rates. And when that happens, the interest on the government debt is going to go through the roof, and it's not going to be able to make those payments. And so, or it'll have much more difficulty making those payments because it's such a high percentage of the tax revenues. And so that's going to cause problems, significant problems.
Yep. Spot on. I actually have to run here in a couple of minutes, Ash. I don't know if you wanted to get to something else before we did. That's about all I have to say on that stuff. But definitely time to prepare on those fronts for sure. That would be the message I leave people with on that aspect.
Yeah, I'm going to look into diversifying my bank accounts for sure. I have my money in small one's a regional bank, and then one is a smaller bank than that. So I'm going to look into the health of my banks and see where I need to put my money. So anyways, yeah, I think that's all I have to say on the topic for today. Government is the problem. Yes, I agree on that, Bob and Ann, for sure. So anyways, good talk, and please like, share, subscribe. We'll be able to leave this one up. I think Jesse made some comments that were not so good yesterday on the injection and the health and safety of it. So we had to take that one down.
I noticed that too. I went to go send the link to someone. I'm like, oh, that was me.
Yeah. But we are one day away from having no strikes on our channel. Okay. So that'll be awesome. So exciting. Yeah, I know. We can only aspire to that, a clean YouTube channel. So, all right, everyone.
A clean social credit score.
Yeah, right. All right. Until next time.
All right. Take care. Thanks.
Bye.